Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. This is the session on instrumentation, and it's fun to be in a group where everybody is so up to date on the latest in instrumentation, except for me, with my ancient Macintosh computer, and I find that everybody who has this old-style Macintosh computer left their power supply back in the hotel today. If there's somebody who happens to have one who doesn't need it for the next little while, I wouldn't mind plugging in some power here. Otherwise, I'll just kind of rip through the things that I was going to talk about, and we can get to the... is this... I'm not sure I recognize... Is that an American plug on it? Okay. All right, so yes, it's that style. Yep. So wait.
So I will buy you a new one if it blows up.
Yes. Oh. Oh, this is one of these European things I don't know, recognize. So, this is designed for 110 volts now, right?
No, they work with any
volt. Yeah, right. Okay. So So I'm supposed to be talking about the future of instrumentation, and here I'm showing myself as one of the more challenged among us. But I'm ready. I invited speakers at the Gordon Conference 2 years ago to think about where technology had brought us over the previous, say, 20 years of the Gordon Conference series, and to think about where it might take us in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years. And to some extent, that was kind of an inspiring look ahead. Not everybody actually had a clear idea of where we would go, but it's not inconsistent with Bob's pointing out that we do tend to underestimate what will happen in the long run. But it was a ton of fun to think of where the field has come in the last 20 years and to see that it seems like every meeting we go to, including this one, the bar keeps getting raised for the productivity that's expected of cryo-EM groups in terms of number of structures we keep cranking out and the resolution and the quality and so on. And certainly instrumentation has a significant factor in the improvements that we continue to see. What I wanted to do in the context of this workshop or this panel discussion, and panel discussion has a limited sense here, it seems, although there will be a few other people that talk. Mostly I'd like to get audience participation. Audience participation has so far been a little bit limited. I wanted to ask a lot of people what they see as rate-limiting steps in what we do right now. On the one hand, productivity seems so high that we don't really see rate-limiting steps at this point. In my own lab, just recently, Chuck Sindelar, who's been looking at kinesin-decorated microtubules for, well, it seems like forever. It's only been a couple of years, but just in the last few months, he's got everything working well and actually can crank out a structure at 9 angstrom or 8 angstrom resolution in about 2 weeks. And you know, for us, that's a it's kind of a joyous breakthrough, I have to say. And so that in a sense, that's so much faster than I had expected we would be working a year ago that I don't see anything limiting us, except that what if we could do a structure every 2 days? We've got enough ideas of things we would like to do. We could keep busy for a couple of weeks cranking out structures every 2 days. But we're still in the dark ages of going in and sitting at the microscope and looking at everything and taking pictures really by hand. But Chuck can collect 100 pictures in a good session and then process them by hand, selecting microtubule stretches and Sort of the image processing is somewhat automated, but it's in the context of things done in this building here, it's really kind of old. But it's not instrumentation that limits us right now. And as I went around and asked people at the meeting here, where in this transition from specimen to 3D map and beyond that Ron Milligan talked about, is there something in this region here going from, well, really not so much damage, but the microscope, somewhere in this section up here, is there some instrumentation-related rate-limiting step? I didn't get much response. Remember David DeRosier asked everybody to tell me what ideas they had about rate-limiting things? Nobody actually volunteered to come in, so I was discussing with David whether that meant there were no rate-limiting steps or whether people just weren't listening to him and heard the call. I wish I could. There's not enough room in nature for all of us, actually. Wait a minute. I may have said that wrong. Mother Nature loves us all. I didn't mean to imply that. I did get answers from some people when I asked them what would they consider their rate-limiting steps. As you know, WASI's money is the primary limitation, and to some extent that's a legitimate problem for everybody. But he also admitted that computing power is a bit of a problem. He's in a position where he can collect so much data in his group that they're actually limited by how long it takes to process the data. And that's also not uncommon for other people. Vincent suggested that money was a problem also. You know, for somebody younger in their career than WA, this is at least as big a problem, just to kind of get over the threshold of getting started. For WA, the money is more an issue of getting more people into the lab, probably, for Vincent and some others. Maybe it's getting basic instrumentation. And I hope that I might actually be able to get a couple of people who are sort of getting started, Scott Stagg and Andres Leschner, to talk just a little bit about the issues that they see in terms of getting into basic instrumentation and beyond as they set up their own labs. Vincent has seems an issue that a lot of us have. There just aren't enough microscopes in the lab. And then there aren't enough computers. But that's not the direction that I was heading. Fred Sigworth is the only one that I asked that said the right answers. both of the right answers. That image contrast is a real limitation, which will be solved when we have a functioning phase contrast device like Bob Glaser talked about. And the fact is, that is going to make such a difference in terms of ability to find and identify and box out particles that I think that may be a sort of quantum leap once these are available to everybody. And then I was also pleased that he mentioned that better recording devices would improve the situation as well. And that's something I'm going to address in a couple of minutes here. For Nigel, Nigel, of course, is a special case in many ways. You know, Nigel seems to collect most of his data in Japan, and although he said when I was discussing with him that it still can take him an hour or a day to find a tube that's right, he wasn't thinking in terms of that as a rate-limiting step. Can you imagine if Nigel could collect 100 images in a day rather than one? Well, just imagine. Why does Nigel have to go to Japan? Why do any of us have to go to Japan? So I first actually asked Anchi Cheng, who reminded me that she'd started out in synchrotron work and left that because it got to be kind of boring. Imagine recruiting somebody from a generation younger than anybody in this room here to join a lab and telling them, so Nigel can find a good specimen almost every day, and he needs maybe 100. And, you might be able to get, say, 4 or 5 days a week. So, this is setting somebody up to think in terms of spending their first 2 years collecting data. That's driven some people crazy around us, actually. When she did switch to electron microscopy, she immediately, as one of the people who likes to get her fingers down deep into things, discovered that as a novice, she couldn't get into the level of control of the systems that she wanted. Of course, she's become an expert user now and is probably one of the people who gets her fingers deeper in. But she actually was frustrated by not having the level of control that she'd wanted at the beginning. Of course, this was intentional. People don't build complicated systems and then let novices go mess with them. So there is an issue of the learning curve that in most of the electron microscopy that we do takes an inordinately long time. Several people did mention that they would really like a better stage than they have right now in terms of stage stability, the sample exchange, being able to go through a lot of different samples as you're screening data, screening samples. Would be a tremendous help. But that's because most everybody has still, they're back in this region here, limited by their specimens. But if you can get beyond the specimen, then what? The fact is that maybe it's because it's hard to get beyond the idea that the specimen is so limiting that people weren't coming up with a lot of ideas. But there are a few things that some people have that some of others of us would really like a microscope in Japan, or maybe the microscope like the one in Japan or the several in Japan. But, is that really necessary? Things that have helped us, some of us, and that some people would like, but not everybody actually has ready access to, includes things like a higher voltage microscope. But in fact, almost all of us have at least 200 kV microscopes now, and it's the level of productivity of them is really quite amazing. A number of us have liquid helium capable stages at this point, and a fair number of us who have those don't put helium in them, we just put nitrogen in them. We can't all have a lab in Kyoto where they do use helium, but certainly for some particular applications, the productivity there is higher, and probably actually has to do with the fact that they use helium in their stage, but also that they have people really dedicated to keep everything running all the time. So obviously, a perfectly eucentric and stable stage is something that everybody would like, especially people doing tomography. Some stages are better than others, and if you can get a new microscope, it probably comes with a pretty good stage. But the fact is, stages continue to get better and better. So automation for tomography and single particle work is available to us all, almost all of us. Well, it's all available to anybody who has a kind of new FEI microscope from Scripps or from other areas. It wasn't available to us with JEOL microscopes, but we've got pretty much everything that runs in Legendon running on the JEOL now, and also Serial EM for doing tomography. But still, there are people who have systems that aren't working up to snuff that could be improved significantly. There's other things of minor importance to most people. Like most folks that do spot scan imaging, even with tilted specimens, well, there's very few people doing spot scan imaging of tilted specimens, actually. But if they would do focus correction with spot scan imaging of tilted crystals, and you know that makes image processing enormously faster. And I did come across somebody, I don't remember who it was, that said their spot scan system just wasn't working well enough to implement this. But the phase contrast aperture, that's not high on the Christmas list for a lot of people here, but as Bob pointed out, I think it will be in a couple of years. There are probably more people who would like to get a spherical aberration corrector. Certainly more people in the general microscopy community, probably not so many in the cryomicroscopy community, because we realize, well, a lot of us realize, or some of us realize, that a CS corrector is going to give us a perfectly contrastless image at exact focus, and that is not a big improvement. But chromatic aberration correctors are something that a lot of people are looking forward to, especially those of us who work with thicker specimens. But again, there's a real justified debate on the value that these are going to actually give us. I didn't put an energy filter on here, but I think that would be well above the C corrector on the wish list for a lot of us. And certainly, almost everybody would like a larger format digital detector. No matter how big yours is right now, you probably want one that's bigger, or faster, or more efficient. That's something that's kind of dear to my heart that I will discuss a little bit, especially given the nice introduction that David DeRosier showed on Sunday night here. This was his slide, and I guess he only had a picture of a FEI microscope. We actually have this decelerator that we've been building for some time. On the JEOL microscope. Why did I put the red thing in front of it? It's not just the humor value, it's the intimidation that the operator sees as they walk up to the microscope. So I have another picture that's a close-up operator's view. This is the electron decelerator camera that has been talked about in a couple of contexts here. It's a system we've been building for some time where the idea is to overcome the degradation of performance of the CCD camera when you hit it with high-voltage electrons. Basically, they splatter too much in the scintillator and the substrate that supports it. So what we do is to slow the electrons down until they hit the scintillator much more gently. So there's a high-voltage section inside here, and this tank is both a high-voltage insulator filled with high-pressure sulfur hexafluoride, and there's a vacuum section inside. This is basically the idea. There's the camera is down in a box here, floating at high voltage so that the electrons slow down before they hit it. And this is a little more detailed view. All of the electronics for the Gatan camera that we've packaged into this are in a box that sits down here. Everything in red is sitting at the high voltage. So the electronics are all floating at high voltage, and there's fiber optic lines that take signals in and out and so on. So people often ask, how is it working? And I say it's working very nicely. It's been a very painfully slow process. But this is just one example of the improvement that we get in a fairly, the transform of a fairly noisy image of a carbon film. So just looking at carbon films again and the Fourier transform. This is illuminating the camera with 250 kV electrons. In this image here, the electrons going through the sampler are still at 250 kV, but they're slowed down to 50 kV before they impact on the scintillator. And my expectation was that slowing them down would improve the modulation transfer function as a dominant effect. And there is a substantial improvement in that. But the biggest improvement actually comes from the decrease in noise level. It's a noise source that arises primarily from the variation in the number of photons created per electron as they scatter randomly within the scintillator. So basically, you can see a lot more detail in the transform here. And this is expressed better in the spatial frequency-dependent DQE. And if you don't like DQE, don't worry about it. Just look at the changes in the DQE curves as we go from illuminating with a very low voltage, ridiculously low, to an incident energy around 50 kV. So here we have DQE that's about 0.7 at low frequency, 0.5 at half Nyquist frequency. And compared to the normal DQE in these red curves that we get with our normal 300 kV incident electron. So there's about a factor of 5 improvement in the DQE at half Nyquist frequency of the camera here, which is really a remarkable improvement. And in fact, we can, so this is it's a 4K CCD chip that we're using right now with 15 micron pixels, and we can actually use it as a real 4K imaging system. These electrostatic systems do tend to have significant distortions, and the question of distortions came up earlier. It turned out that most of the distortions were actually caused by the way we designed a section of the system right above the CCD. There's sort of a drift space between the decelerator tube itself and the CCD. We had a square tube going down to the CCD. And it turns out the transition from the circular profile of the decelerator tube to that square was distorting the fringing fields that drift down into this drift tube. And causing significant distortion. When we rounded that out, we got rid of almost all of the distortion. But still there is some, and as we decelerate from a higher voltage to perhaps even lower, so if we want to go from 300 to 40 kV, distortions will be a significant problem. And they're already a problem that need to be resolved. So I just took some images of purple membrane. And aside from the fact that we could see diffraction spots essentially right out to the Nyquist frequency, this was just a demonstration that we could measure the distortion pattern. In some more recent work, I've used a spot scan array to characterize the distortions and then apply a fixed distortion pattern to images of purple membrane. And you can see even the diffraction spots in the transform of the image are horribly blurred out by distortions in the raw image. But after correcting the distortion pattern, the spots come right back down to sort of single pixels. So the progress on this thing continues. And we're looking towards the next generation system, which I think will, if everything goes right, this will build a decelerated camera with a 10K by 10K CCD chip. So 10K chips are on the horizon. But of course, as the CCD format gets larger, the number of pixels gets larger, the pixel size gets smaller. And although that's a horrible and increasingly bad mismatch to the normal point spread function of the scintillator at 300 kV, we can actually take advantage of the smaller pixel size when we decelerate the incident electrons. So even the CCDs don't turn out to be the way of the future for these detectors. Something like the Metapix with a decelerator would be a super system. CMOS may end up as the preferred system, but I think the prospects for seeing a tremendous increase in the efficiency and the format size of a detector is really quite good. So a 10K by 10K CCD would provide almost the same data that we get on a typical film micrograph now, digitized at 6 or 7 micron resolution. So that's one aspect of instrumentation that probably will affect lives of some people. So there's another issue that sort of affects me personally that I just wanted to toss out as an idea for somebody here to take on. And that's something that comes up in tomography, where we tend to be looking at samples that are already a little bit thicker than we should be using to get real high resolution. So this is an intact frozen hydrated bacterial cell. It's a D. sulfovibrio vulgaris. They're a little bit thick, and this is already squashed down just a little bit, so you can actually see through it quite nicely. But when you tilt it up to 60 degrees, you have the problem that they get really dark, and so the thickness in projection here is way beyond what we use for any of the mathematical approximations and assumptions that we use in reconstructing images. And to some extent, that's because, as you can see, there's sort of a meniscus of the buffer that builds up around the cell. And so we're basically looking through a slab of liquid here, and you turn a slab up on even to 60 degrees, or 63 degrees, the thickness doubles. If you try to go to 70 degrees, it's so much worse. One idea to get around this problem would be to take advantage of either an ion mill or maybe even the electron beam in the microscope and get rid of the slab adjacent to the specimen. So now this you could look at along a tilt angle like this, and the projection of the specimen wouldn't be any thicker than it is going in this direction here. So that would be a small incremental improvement. Maybe we could do that with the electron beam in the microscope right now without anything, any additional technology. But what we'd really like to be able to do to work with samples that are just where the cell is already too thick is to actually scrape off the top somehow. And again, using an ion beam to just kind of mill down the top would be just the perfect approach. So many of you are probably familiar with dual beam FIB instruments, focused ion beams, where a beam of gallium atoms is used to ablate a surface. They're used all the time in the material science industry. And Sriram Subramaniam and Mike Marco and probably others have had some success in milling down even frozen hydrated samples to appropriate thicknesses. What I'd love to have is something where I could look at the sample in the TEM and identify promising cells and then mill off the top. So I'd like a dual beam FIB that's built into a TEM rather than an SEM. And folks at the National Center for Electron Microscopy just told us about a new mill system that uses buckyballs instead of gallium atoms. And so there's an issue of matching the atomic number of the impacting atom to the atom you're trying to get rid of. If you hit organic materials with gallium, you cause a substantial amount of damage. In addition to implanting a certain layer of gallium into organic material. Apparently, the buckyball system works because the buckyballs, which are typically 60 carbon complexes, hit the surface and explode on the surface. And so then you have individual carbon atoms that have enough energy to remove other carbon atoms. And you can almost imagine just kind of hitting this thing top down and ablating the surface to the right level. So I doubt that I'm ever going to build one of these, and I actually doubt that it would be built in the TEM that I would be using. But as an accessory for TEM, it would be a real treat. Of course, it might turn out that cryosectioning is all we ever need, but this would allow you to actually identify particular areas, particular cells that have all the characteristics that you're looking for and work much more efficiently than I think you could be able to do just working with a section. So it's a little bit hard to separate the instrumentation from other aspects of technology like specimen preparation and the methodology that we use for image interpretation and image processing and so on. But there are a number of things that I think are at this point incompletely understood by everybody that really will probably affect the way instrumentation develops. And I think it's important for us to have a good appreciation of some of these. And just a couple of examples is one is the mixture of different contrast modes that we have in electron tomography of thicker samples. So there clearly is a significant component of phase contrast, but there's definitely far more amplitude contrast than we can attribute to a weak phase object. And I think that better understanding of the imaging modes, or better accounting for imaging modes in the reconstruction processes that we follow, would help us a lot. This is not something where technology per se is going to help, but I think it's something that relates to questions like, should we have a 500 kV microscope next instead of a 300 kV microscope? Might actually be a useful guide. So as I set up here, some of us, but not all of us, have very strong opinions on some of these and how important they are in driving technology. So the issue of correctors in biological microscopy in general is a subject that actually provokes some interesting and spirited discussions where the differences of opinions show up nicely. I think it's going to be experimental data that convinces people, and there are a number of areas where a number of installations where CS correctors are now available, and it won't be too long before there are chromatic aberration correctors for imaging systems. And I think it'll be interesting to see what improvements actually appear. In sort of the same context, the question actually came up here, as well as in Berkeley just a couple of days before we came here, about the value of STEM imaging in biological applications. STEM has a lot of appeal for material scientists, and it's an incredibly productive mode of imaging. But as far as I know, nobody's ever shown a picture of even something like TMV in the STEM mode that compares to the typical TMV image in the TEM mode. And there's I think, a lack of understanding of even why that is. So it's not entirely for lack of trying, but the people who are trying to do STEM imaging are not the ones who have maybe the greatest experience in TEM imaging of biological samples. So in the context of STEM imaging, one of the biggest advances that could be kind of the breakthrough in terms of applying STEM imaging for biological applications is having a bright field detector that's segmented into enough individual readouts that one could take advantage of the phase contrast bright field signal. I'm not going to go into that anymore, but that's an area where material scientists are probably going to have to take the lead. And there's, as far as I can tell, there's not a tremendous motivation for them to do it. But it's a potential area where there could be a mode of imaging that would be far more efficient than what we use in conventional TEM.
In principle, so, yes. STEM imaging would be really useful in tomography because you could correct the change in defocus as you go across, as you scan up the tilt ramp. But
right.
What I'm wondering
right.
is whether, do you, if you have specimens suspended over a hole, do you with STEM get rather bad charging?
So the question for those in the back from Dr. Taylor here is if you're doing spot scan imaging, STEM imaging. Freudian slip. Spot scan imaging or STEM imaging has an issue of charging when you're looking at non-conductive samples like ice over holes. And I'm sure that there would be a problem of charging in a STEM image on even an untilted sample. of ice embedded specimens. Bob?
But one can always evaporate carbon onto the...
Sure. Right. Which is such a nice segue to this next point here of electron beam induced conductivity or some other factor that makes the charging of ice embedded samples so much less when you have a highly conductive support film. When the holey film is conductive, the ice and sample within the hole seems to charge substantially less. And why that is kind of a mystery to me, and I tend to explain it because by some effect of electron beam induced conductivity, where electrons excited in the support film actually have enough energy to propagate within the non-conductive layer over substantial distances. In any case, I think the fact that Yoshi and perhaps also Nigel have been so adamant about the necessity of care when you're evaporating carbon films, for example, to avoid sparking and to treat the films to enhance the conductivity, even if it's only by their measured factor of two. The fact that these are so important in image quality convinces me that there is some really significant issue of the conductivity of the support film, and the semiconductor holey film that Joel showed on, I think on Monday, I think is a tremendously promising advance, and this could be one of the other breakthroughs that increases the productivity of cryo-EM by an unknown factor. But if this electron beam conductivity, induced conductivity, is really plays a factor in that, being able to enhance that or control it somehow within the ice layer might be another tremendous advance. So again, it's not really an instrumentation issue, but it's an issue of sort of technology that relates strongly to how the instrument actually performs. Similarly, the effect of very low temperature, some of us feel we've explored this ad nauseum, and there are still dogmatic opinions that are not all in total agreement. Certainly, we've seen some effects with specimens at liquid helium temperatures that make the very low temperature operation worse than at nitrogen temperature. But there is this long history of spectacular results from Yoshi's lab looking at samples on, at least glucose or ice-embedded samples on carbon films, that seems to argue that there is a very substantial improvement with helium temperatures. And then, although a number of us have looked for dose rate effects over the years, the fact that James Chen shows something that's so unambiguous really is an inspiration. Whether the effect that he sees, which I attribute to diffusion, to slow diffusion of volatile fragments knocked loose by the electron beam within the sample, and that diffusion being inhibited at low temperature, but still perhaps fast enough so that these fragments can diffuse if given enough time. This may not relate very strongly to very high resolution imaging, but certainly to some of the things that we try to do in electron tomography. So there is the question, if we know what we want, how do we get it? Certainly, I think it's important to continue to interact or recruit other scientists from fields such as physics and material science to help explain issues like beam-induced conductivity and so on. Certainly it's important for some people to continue to explore these technological innovations, but there is the question of how to fund them. So a lot of the inspirations for new ideas and do come from the academic community. It could be said that they all come from the academic community, or I suppose there must be some in other fields that come from companies and, you know, the semiconductor industry, for example. But most of the things that affect, you know, the instrumentation advantages that have really affected us directly, I think have come out of research labs mainly supported by NIH, and certainly to some extent NSF, and to a much lesser extent DOE. Getting these funding agencies to commit to something like developing the decelerator or a phase plate is not easy. One really has to wonder what's the prospect for the next great idea actually getting funded without some substantial seed fundings from some source. And it seems to me at this point the private funding is a better source for seed funding than anything else, but I don't know how to generally get that. So that's an open question. Certainly partnering with industry is going to be critical for the eventual development to commercial product of a lot of our ideas. And we could just wait for industry to develop what we want, but taking industry by the hand and leading them along is I think, what many of us really have to do. But industry doesn't tend to follow. Industry has its own regulations and its own practices and limitations. And I thought it would be very informative, if not at least entertaining, to have a couple people from industry describe a little bit about the process that a company goes through when it, either in developing its own internal ideas or ideas that come from groups like this into commercial and viable products. And so I've asked Alki von Behlen and Linda Melanson to give little presentations. Alki, as you know, has been with FEI for some significant amount of time. I actually don't know how long. Maybe about a lifetime. And so has the perspective of developing products within one of the principal microscope suppliers. Linda has a long and storied career as a microscope user and then worked with FEI as a sort of customer representative for a while, which gave her a very interesting perspective for her new position in Gatan, where she's responsible for some developments. And of course, Gatan and FEI have, you know, they're very different companies and they have very different constraints and practices. And so I think it'll be fun to get a sense from the two of them about how products actually develop. And maybe we can get some insights on how to work with companies, how to manipulate companies, how to inspire them, how to lead them to where we want to go.
Well, let's see. There's a special part. So, you see, photography, I have this nice dual personality these days, having red dot, being a student. So, signal to noise ratio is even important for the. Okay, so I have this dual personality today, being a student, having paid Bridget $500 to get in, because that's, if you're not .edu, then. But let's see, we do have a number of challenges. And when I wake up this morning, I was not knowing that I got this presentation. but as FEI has a corporate legal department, I put in a caveat. This is just my personal thought. And because exactly. So don't tell us the lawyers that I told it. And we'd be completely off topic. But we do have some boundary conditions in FEI, and that just like everyone else. But ours are completely different, and the same holds, Linda, for Roper and Gatan associated companies. That is, first of all, we are a NASDAQ stock noted public company. And if you would like to spend your money, go to FEIC, put it there, and you are absolutely sure that you will have a better microscope next time. So that is the plug. But more seriously, and that is really interesting, going from a fellow background, you know, I have been for this company not a lifetime, exactly, I'm not that young, but for more than 25 years. The interesting thing, Wall Street watches our performance. And the amazing thing that happens when we moved from Philips, a big Philips, to FEI, is that Wall Street, then you have to publish how much you spent, obviously, on R&D. And Wall Street was saying, what? Are you spending that little? So we have to crank up our R&D spending significantly. And to give you an indication, we went from, I think, 60 or 70 R&D staff, all of a sudden to 180, 200, because that was Wall Street was expecting. Now, we don't mind, and that's why we could do a lot more than previously. Secondly, Wall Street doesn't like surprises, because you have all this big money going in, which means that we have to have good quarter results every time. So the big push on the factory especially is from get the thing out of the door, because the quarter results have to be good, etc. So that is one of the things driving us very significantly, the fact that people with no interest in electron microscopy, only looking at dollars, are watching over your shoulder and saying, well, this is not too brilliant. Now, what we are serving for market, essentially, nanobiology, as we call it, nanoindustry, nanoelectronics, and nanoresearch, and for the people or a little familiar with Dutch, you know what bier means, bier, if you. So why that is not the case. But you, all of you, have to work harder, because if I look to the market segment, this is just coming from the our annual report, you see we are pretty strong in nanoelectronics and everything that has to do with chips and that kind of things. And the Intels, the AMDs, and the ST Thompson, Infineon and those people. Nano research and industry, that is the traditional life, the material science people and the people like ExxonMobil and God knows who make catalysts and that kind of people, is 34%, and this is where you are. So you have to work a little bit harder, and we do have now our new vice president for nanobiology, Matt Harris, who is whose, let's say, performance a judge on growing this market. So please buy more instruments, because that would make Matt Harris extremely happy. But you see, that is interesting. Nanobiology is still the smallest market, and we have absolutely decided, let's say, Don Kenia, our CEO, and Matt Harris, to make that a significant market segment. Period. That is very dedicated to that. The other pie chart shows that we, and that is also a change, if I can recall, from the old Philips days,
where Europe obviously was the majority when I joined Philips long, long ago. There are three very important people in the sales that were the head of sales in France and Germany and the UK, and that was it. And while you have to serve strange Americans, et cetera, was the time, incidentally, that George Shulls used to be a service technician, so that is what changed a little bit. But now it has completely changed, and the interesting thing to see, obviously, we are still strong in Europe. We are pretty strong in the US, but Asia is also getting very significant, with a significant amount of sales in Japan, not surprisingly, and in India and in China. So, but that is the interesting thing, that what you should make grow. So, now everyone here in the audience is judged about, let's say, the amount of pages you get in publications in Nature, hopefully, or Science, or that kind of high impact factors. We are judged on a totally different scale. And if you're talking about signal processing, this is our performance graph, the largest as I could get out of Yahoo this today. And you see we are doing all sort of wonderful things. And spikes and et cetera. But look at this. Whoops! Interesting transient. What is going on there? We got a new CEO. No, that had nothing to do, and that's what I think you would think. All those people in New York are doing long-term analysis and everything is purely emotional. It has nothing to do with reality, because you also see, if you do some, let's say, signal processing, that the new CEO effect has evaded here again. So it's time to recycle CEOs, it seems. But if you do some more signal processing, a slight upward trend can be seen. But this is completely that's completely illogical. So, but we do have competition. We like competition, else we fall asleep. But note that we are NASDAQ noted, and our competition, JOL, is noted at the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And the Tokyo Stock Exchange seems to be, and quite a best left, less emphasis in profitability, because simply speaking, we would never ever get away with the performance figures our competition is showing on the stock exchange. They have an annual report, and if you see, as flat as a Dutch landscape, you won't get away with that in NASDAQ, because you were dumped and whop you. Maybe a new CEO would help. The other thing is, and that is surprisingly, and that's if you would get people to scare an FBI, you stand in the hallway and you call SOX, and that stands for Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is very, 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 very strict on all sorts of procedures and things and financial reporting. That's one thing, so we have to be very careful on that in reporting profitability. The other thing is that the Securities and Exchange Committee in the US, and as you have seen in the struggle between the European Community, Neelie Kroes, and Microsoft, there is a substantial, let's say, power there, which means that direct government subsidies, as are allowed in Japan apparently, are not possible, neither in the US nor in the European Union, but in Japan this is okay. So there is a direct subsidy of $6 million US dollar equivalent going to JOL. Okay, that's the way they do it. The other point is that Hitachi is doing all sort of wonderful things, making electron microscopes, but also making nuclear power plants or God knows what. So they are not so much interested. I'm wondering what is going on there in terms of TEM activity. They are not so much active anymore. They are active in the SEM world, as I know. The other thing is, in Europe, we do have Zeiss, and Zeiss is privately funded in the Zeiss Stiftung, the Zeiss Foundation, which seems to be have very deep pockets, because if you look to the profitability and all that kind of things, that is also not that good. But, well, if you have deep pockets and you don't have to be accountable for Wall Street, that makes it easier. So that are different conditions. Now, what do you define as a successful product? Point A, people would, there is market demand, but people would like to buy the thing. Yeah? If there are no way of buying, asking for things, that's the first thing. The second thing is it should be accepted in the market. That sounds strange, but you can ask for things that, let's say, and especially in a scientific community, you can bring out a wonderful thing. But if, let's say, all your peers are thinking, wow, this is a strange thing to have, you won't not get market acceptability. Now, the other thing is, in order to make things successful, you should have a focused effort. That is, don't try to make, in the old days you have those tools who can drill holes and saw and do all sort of things, multiple tools, that is never a good idea. So make one thing which you do one thing well and not too much more, which limits the size of the project and everything, so that's easy. Another question is, it should be scalable. Scalable, that is, people in the factory in FEI or in any other manufacturer should be able to manufacture the thing, not by tweaking it, but routinely. Just put things together, and if you've ever been to the FEI factory, it's amazing to see. You have people who assemble, for instance, a goniometer or something, pop, 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 just routinely, and that's the way it should do, because this is very simple. If it is a routine, your quality is guaranteed and you're absolutely sure if the thing goes out to a customer, that customer is satisfied, and the next thing goes out to the next customer and he is satisfied as well. Now, and which means also, if you do it scalable, gold plating is a bad idea. You better keep your cost under control, because that's the way to keep the profitability up and to make it attractive in the market. And which comes to the next point, maintainability. That is maintained by mere mortals. I must say there are lots of complaints over service, but I must say I admire my colleagues, field service engineers, immensely, because day one they go to an EM400. If, let's say, the older people knows what it is, but younger people, that is a microscope we used to manufacture, I think, 1980, David, something like that. And the next day they are at a CM, and the next day they are at a Techni, and the next day they have this brand new Titan, and they should know everything. And it's 25 years of electronics development, going from the discrete transistor circuits in the AM400 to the latest, greatest Titans stuff, or in the SEM world from SEM 500 to in Helios. So that's also a question of how can we maintain the knowledge in the field, how we can we make sure that our service engineers can service the thing, because having one person to do that is not scalable. So a few developments, recent developments. This one you know and love, hopefully. And I must say I was involved in doing this, and the things which drive this development, and have especially to be thankful to Bridget and Clint on this, because this was one of the main driving forces due to their work they did at that time, automation for Techni. The second thing was the integration of third-party equipment, called impolitely third-party equipment, but you have to think of cameras. We did have a great period of working together with Catan, for instance, to integrate the cameras and all that stuff into one system. So Techni was great. Titan is even greater. And it comes as a price, obviously, because we have to keep Wall Street happy. what we try to do with Titan is essentially the Tech9, as you know, the optics of Tech9 are the optics of the 400, and which are of the CM, and which are the optics of the 400. So 25 years old with all sorts of issues. And we would like to for once and for all, set the pace of the next generation, solving the electro-optical issues. And to do a second thing, to make the stability, the mechanical stability, and the thermal stability of that instrument far better. The trick is, if you ever have seen a Titan, it is built up of rings, big rings, and they are with a nice construct, they're always centered. So the column is always centered, that's one thing. The second thing is, what we did is that all coils have essentially two wires, and with so the dissipation I squared R is kept constant, but varying the, let's say, the balance between the current in the two coils, you can adjust the magnetic field. So that thing is incredibly stable. And the third thing we did is making sure that all lenses, deflectors, and that kind of things are water cooled, so there is no issue in that. And if you make a thing modular by making all these nice pancake things, it is expandable. So lifting, put corrector in, which brings me to the later on about the correctors. Now, there was, due to the excellent work of Fujiyoshi, and apparently a wave at a certain point that everyone would like to do liquid helium, only that we now know everyone puts liquid nitrogen in the Polara, but that's the way it goes. we had an excellent collaboration with Gatan UK, in order to bake this system, because they have the knowledge in terms of all the cold things, and make a system that is liquid helium compatible. That's one thing. Not as good as Yoshi can get. We can again get, I think, 10 Kelvin is the specification. The other thing is that we, due to the cartridge and everything, you can do easy sample exchange. So Polaris has been a huge success in the market as well. This is one of the developments that was driven from the Philips Research Lab. We didn't know if this going to work, so that was found out at Philips Research. Titan and Tech9 were pure developments done by us by carefully listing to customers and sort of extrapolating what the wishes in the market would be. So, correctors, that is very interesting. And the interesting thing is there is an enormous body of, now I say 20 years, but Max Heider is one of them, but Rose and Kral and all the people who worked on correctors, that is the academic society in Germany especially, who do this. And only recently, and that's why you cannot predict all this thing, only recently it became to the level that it is, let's say, feasible. We did have big issues, and that's why we decided not to do correctors on Titans, on Tech9, but on Titans. We did have big issues with making the original design. You may be, if you ever visit the sales in Germany, you may know that Max Heider has built his first system on, I think, an CM, but that was totally impossible. We did have quite some issues, and the big breakthrough came when we could do the things in Titan. And if you got very fancy, but not so much money, there is a possibility to buy your Titan and have a field installed corrector. So you can get your Titan first and later on. Unfortunately, we do only one corrector at a time in a field upgrade. So if you would like to get very fancy, which our material science people do quite a bit, and that's why the factory is screaming and sighting, because the minimum configuration and of a typical configuration in the Titan is at least one corrector, and preferably a monochromator and a tritium thrown in, so that is getting to interesting sales figures there. But we can install correctors because due to the modularity of the system. The other issue you have for people who are so young that they still have to build a microscopy lab, please make it high. The reason is a Titan is rather high in itself, but adding 32 centimeters of corrector, adding to 30 centimeters of corrector and everything, and then putting it in a big box is 4.50 meters, I think, which is chilling the ceiling height of most most buildings. And you can do it either like Wolfgang Baumeister, done it by digging a big hole and dumping everything in the hole. where is it in I forgot his name. In Ohio State, Stehemis Fraser in Ohio State has done the same, make a big hole, dump the microscope in. The other thing is, what is very important, and now we get to the real scientific aspect, that is a machine, let's say a TF-30, as Nico is happy to have, was a couple of years ago the top instrument. Now the top instrument is Titan, perhaps with correctors. And the interesting thing is that is not a simple beast. That is really, I won't say rocket science, but a serious instrument drive. We would like to have people to get results, and instead of waiting for your postdoc to catch up, we have said that you will, that is the 66th grade you get with the instrument, we hired a Philips, an FEI research fellow in that. We have decided that in order to get results, dedicated people called FEI research fellows will be assigned to a specific lab in order to make sure that they can drive that instrument to the specification. And after 2 years, you're, hopefully you're able to do it on your own, but get to that initial learning curve, and I can tell you, getting to the alignment, only the alignment, and getting results from a thing with a CS corrector in, is that not that simple, I think. So much for the correctors. I checked with Jack Coates, but I should not really tell you this, because we are not there yet. But we do have autoloaders, a beautiful thing you put on the back of the column. And for the material science people, they don't care. You just do it at room temperature, but we do have, and the first one is installed at Baumeister's Krios there in München, a cryo autoloader. And if you think that you have an interesting reliability on the system, this really moving things and picking up things, because you can put a cartridge with 12 cartridges in the thing and selecting and put it in the microscope and everything else. So we have run the successful runs, because that was an acceptance requirement. I think 1,500 loading cycles, but let's see how that behaves over a somewhat longer period. So that's one of the things. Now, the other thing is obviously tomography. Everyone knows and loves these days. We have one of the things I had the fortune to start to by noticing that in the discussion with Bram Koster that tomography was an important thing to do. So we started developing acquisition software, you know, all the calibration curves, and that is pretty standard. Even the competition is happily coupling that, working on stem tomography, and that is indeed with the focus ramp things, obviously, because you can nicely focus if you're scanning. That's pretty simple. And then we got to the thing that, well, having acquisition is fine, but how do you do reconstruction? So I said to my colleague Remco Schumacher, do you think you can do some reconstruction? Now, he has an intelligence quotient about 200, because he is an astronomer, and he said, well, I think I can do. So he came back 3 days later. Is that what you meant? So that's where that part started. And due to the fact that we could work with the people from Mercury Systems who happened to know how to tame GPU, NVIDIA graphical processing units, we could implement a very efficient reconstruction algorithm on the GPU, which is quite nice because now you can get short reconstruction done in your lifetime. That speeds up a factor of 60 or 100 or so. That is interesting. The interesting thing, I would like to make a note. David Mastronardi, if you all know and love, is a good friend of mine, and we are not intending to be competition for IMOD. And the reason is very simple. David works 24 hours times 7, which we never can do at the company, obviously. Secondly, he is always on the top of the latest and greatest developments and can change IMOD at will. And therefore, it's not surprising that very many people like to use IMOD because you write David an email and let's say 2 days later the feature is in IMOD and et cetera. The downside to do is, and I would like to make that remark, would you buy a microscope from FEI if I would be the only software engineer be able to write the software for that instrument? Now, obviously, no. And so I hope that there are not so many cars, crossing David Mastronardi's path if he goes from his house to the lab, because then IMOD would be... So, now this is material science, the team project, the aberration corrected microscope. And now I have to pay a principal question to the audience. We have shown that we can do in collaboration with CIOS and the people at Berkeley, Christian Zielowski and others, built an instrument which has 0.5 TEM and STEM resolution. But, as Richard Feynman used to say, there is room at the bottom. What should we do after that? Because that ends it, ends it pretty well. So that is a nice achievement, but now, and I think for this audience a little bit meaningless, but it is nice to do. And the other interesting thing is, due to the fact that the people, and this is, I think, DOE funding, are pushing us so hard, I think we are full 2 years ahead of the competition. I have one. Yeah, that is this thing. That is... at what point in time should we going from idea wishing, etc., to a product? That is a difficult decision. And the first thing, I hope, if you are not agreeing, wave your hand and shout. This is very important to us. There's no way to put things out which you don't agree that it is good, whatever good means. Because we don't want to be caught in that dilemma, I think. Now, of course, it should be technologically possible. You should be able to do it. It should have market value, so you would be able to buy it. And in our case, it adds to the bottom line. The other thing is, we have always more ideas to give you an indication for... At this point, a budget rounds are taking place, and we are 8 people short, so we have more projects. Money is not a limitation. We need 8 more people to do all the things we want. So, what do you... Clint?
I just have one quick question. What does it cost, to develop something like the Titan?
You don't want to know.
That's almost right.
So... That is exactly the next question. Does what do you want us to work on? Bob has some preference, and Ken has some preference, and everyone else, if you hear the audience, should work for a in-column filter. Mark Ellisman down the road is doing this. He will have a tight and high base with 4 big cameras and everything. So, and secondly, in regard to what Bridget is promoting, should we deliver a complete solution, quote, end quote? That is the pipeline. We have worked up front on the Vitrobot, but should we go farther? That's one thing. Secondly, I would like to warn the audience that is this one, method development from actual science. If you're working on your microscope for experimenting with a microscope, don't use that instrument for doing science. That is the big debate. In the old days, we used to test our software on instruments in our application lab just to make people very unhappy for the demo next day. So if you do this, please set aside. That's one of the things, for instance, David Eggert has trouble with, because he's doing method development in cameras and what else, and he would like to do actual science, and that's a bad combination. So last slide, and dreams and wishes.
So it's an interesting question whether we should send them all to you or some of them to our friends at JUL or other places.
We will be the first anyway.
Yeah, it's probably true. And it's interesting in that the four criteria that you had on your market or your development criteria slide, that the scientific value and acceptance by the community are the sort of things that it seems like the academic community has to provide for you.
Yeah.
Anyway, while Linda gets set up, are there a couple of questions specifically for Alki?
What does it cost?
You're not going to get away from
that. I have a feeling that the team project is funded by DOE at about $20 million. I don't know whether that's $20 million per year for 4 years or
no, it is $40 million total, and our part is $8 million or something. Yes.
So one interesting question for us, I think, is...
The team project, I think, has worked very well for that community.
Yes.
And we see that... You know, FEI resources, CEOS resources are all going into developing instruments for these material scientists that we don't want. We would love it if the same amount of effort and resources went into our things. So one question for you is, how did TEAM start? Was that an academic initiative or was it a
that joint? Strictly speaking, that was very interesting, driven very much from the interest that the DOE had. And if you think that we have some big personalities in this room, consider to have the national labs, ONRL and ANL, those assembled. They have been working, I think, fighting for at least 4 years before they got together and say, okay, this is the direction to go, which shows that if all nodes are in the same direction, the government will give the funding, which is expressible funding, and it is possible to do it.
But was that 4 years spent talking to FEI?
No, this was the 4 years were spent talking between LBL, ANRL, whatever, Brookhaven, before, the lab community settled down and came to us and to JOL and to Dion, for that matter. And finally, I think 2 years ago, we were selected as the vendor of choice. But the decision process in the community was larger, took longer than...
So there has been an active discussion among the national labs that have significant electron microscopy material science groups, and they really knew what they wanted, and they developed a coordinated effort to get it. But... I almost got the feeling as I'm trying to solicit ideas for instrumentation advances within this group that we don't have a clear idea of what we want next that we don't have yet. So you're in this line of sight, I see two of the people who have kind of led development, Yoshi and Richard, of ideas that were well ahead of the group for where biological EM could go. But where we go from here is still kind of an open question for me. Anyway, so Linda's going to give us some the insights from a smaller company. And I guess this is sort of a short presentation, and we'll still get to the vendor discussions on time, I think.
I can't. Where do I clip this? Can I put it in? Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me?
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay, so like Alka said, we didn't know we were going to have to speak at this until actually just a few hours ago. So, and I know it's almost meal time, so I make this quick. Like Alka said, we're both publicly traded companies. Roper Industries owns Gatan, amongst many other companies. And really their main focus is how much money they can make for their shareholders. So it makes our job very difficult. And so I couldn't think of a title for my slide, and I finally came up with this one. because at the end of the day, for all of us in this room, whether we work for industry or we work in science, and I've been on both sides of that coin, it all comes down to funding somehow. And so I echo what Alka says about, you know, how we have to deal with the money part of this from the corporate side is very difficult because the people working in the companies were a lot of them, especially in Gatan, a lot of material scientists, very high-level material scientists who really are very keen on solving scientific problems, and getting money to do that is difficult. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about some of my insights from working when I was with FEI after I left Brandeis University, and now with Gatan, which is a bit smaller company and runs a little differently, but there are parallels to be made. So the first thing I've learned from working in the field in industry and especially in marketing and going to a lot of different laboratories around the world is sort of the customer's view of product development. And it sort of starts out like this. You start speaking to the customer and they'll say, well, why does it take so long to develop the product? And then why does it cost so much? And then can I have it for free? That's usually where they end. And there are answers to all of those, but usually not the ones they want to hear. But we have our own algorithm black box here for developing a product in a company, and it's generally referred to as a PLC or product life cycle. But it all starts, there is a process to this within the company, and much like when you want money to fund a project to do your science, we have to do the same thing within the company if we, as we go to these meetings now and help fund meetings such as this, and we learn from you and learn ideas for new potential products that will solve your problems. We actually then have to go back into work and suggest this, and then we may be asked at that point, well, write a grant, and that grant has a specific name in industry. And we have to write a grant. I mean, it's 20, 30 pages of market research and feasibility and all of these other things that go into this. And it's actually quite complicated. And the first time I was asked within Gatan, you open your mouth at the wrong time and say, have you thought of this? And somebody says, no, that's a great idea. Write, you know, materials codes. I said, great. So at any rate, most companies now, especially the microscope companies, are really trying to solve specific problems to meet the needs of their market. For the main reason is they need money. And so we write this internal grant to get it on the radar of the company and hope that the operations board will approve it so that the people then within the company, small groups here and there, can be formed, and the ORB will fund us to then proceed with building this for you. Whatever it is, whatever piece of equipment it is, be a CCD camera or the whole microscope. And this process takes a very long time from conception to sort of alpha studies of building up a product and concept of feasibility, some of the things that Alka referred to in his talk. And there's a very long gating process in this through alpha and beta gating processes and making sure that if you're going to sell it overseas, that it's going to meet their electrical standards so that people don't get, you know, killed in the lab when they're using it and those things, because the board of directors doesn't want to have to deal with lawsuits in regards to those sorts of things. So in this whole process of the gating, part of this is very intense work with the customer sites before the product is ever released to the general public for sale. And this is the part where the communication with the customer is absolutely crucial, because the more in-depth testing on site, on the alpha and beta sites, and the more communication with the customer base at those sites will help produce a product that's better for the masses, obviously, be it a microscope or a cryo holder or a plunger, you name it. So there's a lot of important and constructive complaining that goes on during that. So hopefully by the time a product goes to market, it isn't sort of a pre-sold product where it's just out there to grab money, but it actually has a lot of functionality. And then, of course, after that, it's another process occurs whereby a lot of users start using it then and provide feedback and information to us. So I'm currently actually the product manager for the whole TEM holder line, and I'm getting questions asked of me from material scientists that I never knew could exist. And so it's important to communicate with specific people within the company framework. If you can do that, as Aukus said, send your ideas to him. If you have ideas about things regarding holders, specimen preparation, my background is in cryo-TEM, so I'm always open to those ideas, and those get incorporated into our sort of like product list of potential things that the ORB may eventually approve. So that's really all I wanted to say to you. I think a lot of customers don't understand that the time frame in doing this is long, because we're not working on just one project. The teams that are set up are usually working on several projects at the same time. It's very difficult to get that done in a short period of time, depending upon the product. And I realize that you have lots of options out there, but again, speaking with the company always helps. If you have a question or problems or issues, send an email or complain constructively so that we can try to solve those, because at the end of the day, all of the companies that are producing this equipment are trying to do it to help you get better data at the end of the day. So although the grass is always greener on the other side, I guess, and maybe the mica is too across the Pacific. But anyway, that's all I wanted to say. So.
Okay, so the bottom line is we should really try to promote our ideas within the companies. That's very clear, but not expect immediate response. So are there a few,
yeah, that's
few
true.
Questions or comments? We could be almost on time for the beer and wine, but I'd be happy to open up for comments as well as questions.
You can take it out. It's fine.
Yes, okay, good for
it. The one holder question that comes to mind is the 2-hour DVD watching limit for Legenon. I wondered if I don't, maybe you can't tell us about this, but is it
the
you know,
2-hour? Sorry, I didn't get the word after the 2-hour. I couldn't hear you.
We learned yesterday that a person using Legenon gets to watch a DVD for 2 hours, and then they have to go in and refill the nitrogen in the holder.
They don't believe they study.
So an obvious improvement would be to make a holder that somehow you didn't have to refill yourself. Is this something that you all are thinking about? Is this something you can even tell what that you're thinking about?
My first suggestion regarding this was that, you know, Netflix might be better than just your own library of DVDs, because you can turn them over faster. But yeah, as far as autofilling devices and such, yeah, we do think of those, and other labs have tried these with some success. I know there was an autofilling device here, I believe. Where's Bridget? You did try it and did some experimentation for stabilizing the holder. And some of the things that have been experimented with are the size and volumes of the Dewar. And so and the Dewars are different. As you know, we still supply two different Dewars on site injury cryo holders. One's made in Warrendale, Pennsylvania. One's made in the UK, right? And they have different characteristics. They're made of different materials, and materials have, you know, different characteristics. So I think Bridget and Clint are now experimenting with a different style holder that's made by Gatan, and that's been on the market for a very long time, and it is showing perhaps more stable rates than what they've seen.
But it's still only lasts 3 hours, and I must say we stopped experimenting with auto because we thought we were getting an auto loader. You know, that
right.
Taking so long. Yeah. I mean, we wanted this auto loader from FEI 3 years ago, and it's been put off and put off and put off. Yeah, but our feeling was the manufacturers would be better, and if such a device would come along and be a reasonable price. That reasonable, but $500,000, not, you know, $6 million, then we would buy that and invest, and that's what was so important to us. So we backed off on developing the thing. But if Arby tells me it's going to be another 3 years, we might pick up a development. But a retrofitted one. We don't want to buy Titan in order to get a
There is an issue I thought we would get a lot more into here, but the fact is that Clint asked if we really could conclude right about 5:30, so I think that's what we should do, and I am sure that Barbara Inaki and Steve Pfeiffer, and who is still in the back there with Gatan, and other company people who are here will be very happy to entertain all sorts of questions now.
Jack Coates
is also here. Steve Pfeiffer. I'm going to thank that again.